Hello and welcome to the program. Today, it's one of our rarest, most elusive birds, currently teetering on the edge of extinction. But could the corncrake be about to make a comeback? Protecting nature and wildlife at the heart of our capital city. The grounds of Oris and Uteron come under an ecological spotlight. And it's the perfect time of year to make a date to witness one of nature's most spectacular sights, a starling murmuration.
Ooh, it's now 20 past four. We've been here for about 25 minutes or thereabouts, and that flock has really built up. In fact, some of the birds are dropping under the bridge now to roost for the night.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to me as if we've probably got a few thousand birds now, and I think it's just going to build and build. So now they're going into about, a big loose ball shape, and they're soaring over our heads. Yeah, and more birds are coming in, sometimes just individuals, little flocks of three and four attaching themselves onto this big moving swarm.
Oh, and what a wonderful afternoon we had in Belfast on the Albert Bridge recording that piece of audio. Just to let you know, we'll be playing it in about half an hour or thereabouts. You can hear it all and learn all about starling murmurations. But these starling murmurations can be found all over the country. So ask somebody in the bird fraternity if they know where there's one happening near you, because it is one of nature's most wonderful spectacles. You're looking at me there, Richard, with your own spectacles. What do you want to say to me? No, you're Aina. He's Richard. Aina Glenn and Richard Collins are here. What were you going
to
say?
It is the great spectacle. People go to the Serengeti area to see the wildebeest roaming the African plains, and it's a wonderful sight and all that. But back home, right in their own doorstep, they have an equally wonderful sight. A million starlings in the sky. It's a wonderful experience to be under them and be showered in their droppings.
But keep your eyes open when you're driving at around four in the afternoon, and you might see them. I mean, I was driving across the country the other day. There was nobody telling me there was a starling murmuration, and I could see great swathes of starlings all crossing the road and going off someplace, and I was going the other way, so I could only see the lads coming to the picnic, as it were. But they're not just in Belfast.
I went to Belfast, the reason is that you can go to the Albert Bridge and they roost under the bridge, so they're going to be in the same spot each time you go up.
Yeah, I saw them.
If you go somewhere else, so like Loch Ennell, for example, who went last year, for sure they were there, and they were there in gigantic numbers, but they were on the opposite side of the lock, so they didn't come over our heads at all, and that can happen to you as well. I went somewhere where I could actually get you lovely sounds and create a nice picture. Now, Aina and Richard, have a listen to this sound. It's a bird. It's the backing track, I suppose, of Verily's Summer. It was heard by our parents as they walked to country schools. It was common on our childhood holidays in rural parts, depending on your age, of course. Once plentiful in all 32 counties, the numbers fell to just 136 calling birds in 2011, a decrease of 85% since the 1970s. They are now found only on the western fringes and islands. During our live Dawn Chorus broadcast in May last year, Blonidney Coffey brought us the distinctive sounds of the corncrake while she was at Fota Wildlife Park in County Cork, where the park's director, Sean McKeown, introduced her to some corncrakes.
Do you hear that?
That's lovely.
Yeah. Just as Derek was saying, go to your labba, myself and Sean, we just stayed back for a few more minutes to find out, just hoping we'd hear the corncrake, and there you hear it. That's the corncrake in Fota Wildlife. And we are so excited because we really didn't want Tori to be the only one. Well, we wanted to be first, but there you go, we got there. So there you have it, the corncrake. Isn't it really good? It's a really good sound.
It's terrific, Blonnet. Can we just have a listen to it, please?
Of course.
So the evocative sounds of the corncrake from Fota Wildlife Park in County Cork, brought to us by Blonidney Coffey during our live broadcast of the Dawn Chorus last May. The corncrake visits our shores between April and September each year, and while currently at risk of extinction, a new project aims to reverse its decline. Ireland recently won €4.3 million from the EU to fund a five-year conservation project for this endangered species. Dr. Barry O'Donoghue is head of agri-ecology with the National Parks and Wildlife Service at the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, and he joins us now from our Limerick studio. Hello, Barry. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time out to talk to us. This is great news for the corncrake.
Hi, Derek. Good to talk to you again.
You too.
Firstly, actually, Derek, I need to congratulate you on the television programme you had out there just before Christmas also, Back from the Brink.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, you worked hard on it.
Absolutely, yeah. And essentially, I suppose that's what we're dealing with here, is a species that is very much on the brink, as you outlined earlier on. And so the corncrake was once upon a time ubiquitous. It was right across the country of Ireland, and it has suffered large declines in population and in range. So this project, Corncrake Life Project, will go towards working with local landowners, local communities, to reverse that trend, to try to restore the population.
So it's actually a grant from the EU Life Funding. So is Ireland the only country getting this? Are we the country in the worst mess?
Yes, so we're lucky enough to get it. We put a lot of work into it ourselves in National Parks and Wildlife Service with our partners in the Department of Agriculture, GMIT, Údarás na Gaeltachta and Fóta Wildlife Park. Put an awful lot of work into putting together this application, and we were delighted when we received the good news. So this money will allow us to put money into local communities to work with the landowners, as I said, to restore the habitats and the correct environment that the corncrake needs to survive and to thrive. So, yeah, we're delighted to get it and looking forward to getting going with it soon enough. Yeah.
Barry, are you sure we know what's happened to the corncrake? It's a multifactorial thing. You have this bird flying all the way to Africa. It might be declining as a result of something happening in Africa. It might be the journey there and back to Sahel getting wider. It might be something to do with Ireland and the way farming is done. Do we know the patient has presented and you've carried out tests? Can you say with certainty what the diagnosis is?
Yes, absolutely, Richard. You're absolutely right there. There's multifaceted aspect to decline, like there is with much of our wildlife. It's not just one thing in particular. And in this case, we're dealing with a bird that, you know, it's amazing actually for the size of it. When you think about the corncrake actually being maybe about 150 grams, about the average mobile phone, that weight or the size of a missile thrush flying from Ireland, from maybe the northwest of Ireland all the way down to South and East Africa, it's an amazing trek, amazing feat of nature. And there are many threats along the way. There are even, in terms of its migration also, there are parts of maybe around the Mediterranean where these birds would be persecuted. And obviously also then issues on their wintering grounds. And it's amazing when you think these birds might be hanging around in Belmullet or up in Fonnet during the summertime, out around Whitehead cows or Shirley cows, and then during the wintertime they're down around under the legs of elephants. So there's a number of different things going on in the wintering grounds, as you say, but what we can do here, and we have a real onus and responsibility and an obligation in Ireland to protect these birds, and what we can do about it is on our own doorstep. And we know that there are issues, particularly the move from haymaking, which would have been traditionally done, you know, down through the decades, to silage making, the homogenisation of the agricultural landscape, increased fertiliser applications, earlier cutting of silage, receding of grasslands, etc., more efficient and bigger machinery, all of these things. And even actually also on the other side of the coin, we have land abandonment in certain places. And the corncrake, she's a little bit like Goldilocks. It doesn't like its porridge too hot or too cold. It needs a certain type of management.
It's just right. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So we're hopefully going to restore some of that balance in the areas that we're going to be working in.
So if you think about it, I mean, the corncrake comes back to where it was born. Isn't that right? I mean, they're faithful to their nest sites. So the years that the Shannon overflowed and the Callows were flooded, there were no birds fledged from those nests, which meant really then there were no birds with that imprinted on them to come back. And they have a very short life for such a big bird. I mean, it's only 2 or 3 years, isn't that all that they live?
Both up to 4 or 5 years, but yeah, some of them 2 or 3 years, that'd be it.
So I mean, the ones in the Shannon aren't coming back there, not because the Shannon Callows aren't maybe suitable, but nobody remembers having been born there. So how can you overcome that? How can you get them to spread? Or is it only coming out from the areas where they are at the moment, spreading it out from Mayo, from Donegal, or can you establish a new bulkhead someplace?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, you touched on something really important there. So as well as the drop in population, there has been a major decline in range also, 92% decline in range since 1978. So, you know, when you're dealing with a population, effectively, if all your eggs are in one basket, if something happens in that area, you know, so we've lost them from the Shannon Callows. Last time we had a calling male there was 2014. If we lose them from Connacht, or if we lose them from Donegal, the chances are they're not going to repopulate there naturally. So we need to consolidate those populations and build from there. And if birds do turn up elsewhere, like last year there was a bird in Kerry, birds will turn up in Sligo, we need to look after those also.
Is the model correct, Barry? The corncrake arrives back in Ireland, and it arrives, say, to the Shannon Carrows, say, if it came from there originally a long time ago. And it seems to need, it seems to assess the place. You find this kind of thing. I used to go to Inishbofin every year, and the corncrakes would call, a few corncrakes would start calling earlier, and then they would stop. And they, in other words, they seem to think, well, they tried the place out, we'd call a few times, see if there are any females around or whatever, and then when they find there aren't, or they don't get a good enough response, they say, we've got to move on, we're going to go up to Donegal, things might be better there. So is it a question that birds are tied to where they were born, or that they come back to where they were born, and if it's not good enough they are prepared to go and search elsewhere, and there must be a kind of threshold number of females around before they're going to settle? Is that model, it's nonsense?
So the general knowledge is that the birds will return back to where they grew up, where they would have, it's thought that they fix on the stars, that's their map to guide them back to Ireland again. But yes, birds will move if they don't have a partner. So if a male will drop into an area and he's calling, he's looking for a mate, he's hoping to attract in a female with his beautiful song. So if that doesn't happen, then he might move on again and try his luck elsewhere, as you say. Towards that, actually, there's GMIT, who are partners with us on the project. They have a really novel, innovative and pioneering project that will be underway using passive acoustic monitoring. So they will be putting out listening devices, listening for the corncrakes. And I suppose, just like us talking here, if somebody was to create a sonogram of each of our different microphones or feature our voices, we will sound different. And each corncrake also, if you analyse their sonograms, they will sound different, and you're able to identify, you're able to actually uniquely identify the same individual. So we will then hopefully be able to tell Larry here, this corncrake, he was calling in Falmore at the tip of the Mullet Peninsula last week, but now he's moved up to Binghamstown and further up the Mullet Peninsula next week. So we'll be able to get a better handle on the exact population, and also we'll be able to tell different individuals apart. So I really look forward to that aspect.
So who's moving from one place to another? So you were saying about Goldilocks' porridge, and that it has to be just right. Now, anyone can understand, if you give the place a number one haircut, which is what Silas Macon is in the month of May, there's not much cover for the poor corncrake, so that's fair enough. But if you just don't do it, or you abandon it, and you've got rank fields with nettle, surely that's grand. Why has it to be just right? Can you kind of outline the ideal habitat?
So if you imagine if you're a small little corncrake and you're trying to, okay, you need cover, you need that tall vegetation when you arrive from Africa in late April, early May. But then if that cover is too rank, if it's too strong and it's all matted, you can't weave through it, you can't walk through it, you can't run through it. And also your chicks will find it very hard to manoeuvre through it as well. So if it becomes too strong, if it becomes too abandoned, too matted, then they can't operate too well within that either. So it's oftentimes, I suppose, we associate the decline with the intensification of agriculture, and that is true. That's the major decline in Ireland, at least. But also, abandonment is also a threat.
Yeah, because a field that hasn't been mowed ever, like for years and years. The grass, I mean, it's a tussocky plant, so that you end up with a big tussock and a big tussock. So if you walk through it, even if you're coming down from the mountains and you have the misfortune to go through a field like that, it's actually much worse than the mountain itself, because you're up and down and in and out. So it's actually quite... So totally abandoned is no good either. Yeah. So what do you actually need then? So not the silage, because that removes the cover too soon, and not the abandonment because it's too hard to walk in. So then what is the management structure that isn't happening as much as it used to then?
So in some of those areas, you might have an area that's just totally become overgrown. It's all briars and bushes. We might need to get in and talk to the landowner and see if they would be happy to work with us. To get some incentive to put that land back into action, that there is some harvest going on there again. But obviously the harvest needs to be at the right time of the year, not during the nesting season, but after the nesting season.
So how do the hay meadows work then? I mean, the farmers were doing that not to suit any corncrake. That was just the way they were doing it for though. So what were they actually doing? When were they mowing?
That's it. So it was late summer. It'd be late August. September would have been more before. I actually remember hay being done in my own home place, and that would be the time of the year. It was good and late.
As late as that.
That allowed the... Yeah, well, we were in Kerry also, so I suppose we were wet.
Yeah, we were wet allowed. We cut the hay in July, but we didn't have many corncrakes now that
Then that would... You see, the corncrake also is what we call double brooded, so it actually might rear two clutches. It might rear two broods in a year.
Yeah.
So maybe the peak season for the first clutch might be in June. They might start hatching, but then they'll go again and you have your second brood, and that second brood would be really at risk. And actually these days even the first brood is at risk, because I suppose when the corncrake arrives from Africa, it will see maybe silage fields, that the grass is that bit longer than the rest of the landscape, and they'll say, oh, that looks really nice, I'll drop into that. But, you know, in a few weeks' time then, or maybe in the month of May or June,
they don't realise it'll be harvested.
Yeah, exactly.
Barry, Anna and I went on a most memorable trip to the Brzeza marshes in the middle of Poland. Now, the interesting thing, among the many interesting things there, were the number of corncrakes. And we were with a man who had took out his comb or his mobile phone, I think it was, and played a very weak corncrake sound into the... And up comes the corncrake right beside us, this sort of thing. So they had a tremendous profusion of corncrakes, but that was not the only thing. They had a tremendous profusion of everything. They had warblers, they had golden orioles, they had everything and anything.
But in that area,
it seemed to me that what was benefiting the corncrake was benefiting everything. Now, is our focus in this project too narrow? The whole rural agricultural world is going down as far as conservation is concerned. We've lost the corn bunting. Other creatures are the yellowhammer, for instance, the grey partridge. There's a huge drop. The whole is right across the board, of which the corncrake is one. Now, the various candidates for that seem to be the lack of diversity in the plant life, in the agricultural scene, and the result that there's nothing for the babies to eat. Now, should we be focusing in a general way and spending 5 million on trying to recreate the kind of habitat they still have in Poland? What was there in the 1950s with the flowers and the weeds and everything in it? Would that be the solution? Should we try to get back to that halcyon day long ago when corncrakes and everything else thrived?
You're absolutely right, Richard. And we would like to see our project as multifaceted, that it's not, okay, so the corncrake is out there as the flagship or the iconic species, if you like to call it that. He's the poster boy. But by managing for corncrakes, we're also hoping to manage for a wider array of biodiversity. So we have already trialled some farm plans. One example might be a guy that a lot of people on Twitter might know, Fergal O'Quinnigan. He has a farm plan with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and he's ostensibly managing for corncrake, but in doing so he has created beautiful species-rich meadows that are actually hosting great yellow bumblebee, twite, chough, you name it. So we would hope to get to that stage, and we would like to see our project as multifaceted, as I said, but also not just looking at the biodiversity, but also looking at the communities in these areas, looking at the people, the landowners, the farmers in these areas. This should hopefully be money going into their pockets to maintain their viability also, because we depend on them. And also, I suppose, the Gaeltacht, that'll be a large focus of our project, and obviously being part of the Department of Culture, Heritage Gaeltacht, that's a major remit of ours also. You know, maintaining the Irish language in these areas, drawing people into these areas to come and see and listen to the corncrake, bringing tourism into the areas, more viable local communities. So it is a project about the corncrake, but we would hope to hit a lot more than that.
Yeah, because, I mean, getting the farmers to do it, I mean, they're the people who own the land. I mean, the last one that we did in Ireland was the Natterjack toad, and there was money given to farmers down in your own neck of the woods in Kerry to scoop out extra ponds for them, because the Natterjack toad was doing very poorly. And the farmers did, and the toads came back. I mean, we were all talking on it about how this was going to happen, like we're talking now about the corncrake, but we didn't ever come back and say, well, it did actually work. It actually worked quite well. And the numbers of Natterjack toads increased considerably because that was taken on board. And the farmers were advised, they got some grants to do this, and they did it. So I assume in the same way with the corncrakes, then they will actually be given advice by the agricultural advisors, by yourselves, as to what actually they must do. And then if they do it, they will get a grant to do this. I presume the money doesn't depend on whether the corncrakes come or not.
Correct. Yeah. So the
advice, not a bonus for the corncrakes arriving.
What one of the aspects of it will be that the better the habitat produced, the greater the payment. So we will be looking at a results based aspect to it, and I think that's fair. And obviously, like you say, we need the landowners advised properly, and agricultural planners, agri-environmental planners will be very much part of this also, that they will be talking with the landowners. The local project team will be talking with the landowners. And in my experience, and I've been working in agri-ecology now for a while, there isn't a farmer out there that actually doesn't want to see nature on their farm. They are out there farming day in, day out. They see the nature that's on their farm, and they would like to help it if at all possible. So if there are proper incentives and if there is proper advice, very important that the advice is there, that the habitats and the species can thrive.
So is it only a designated area that this money is for? I mean, because sometimes, as you know, when the corncrakes are coming, they might hit land in Wexford or someplace and they'd be calling for a day or two and then they'd push on. I mean, could somebody in another part of Ireland say, well, listen, you know, could I not sort of smarten up my place and have it for the corncrakes too? Or is this just confined to the areas of the west and north that you have outlined in the beginning, the Gaeltacht areas?
The project will be concentrating on 8 areas, including 9 special protection areas or SPAs. But obviously, if a corncrake turns up somewhere else and if it begins to breed somewhere else, say down in Kerry or in Sligo, outside of the SPA areas, then we would have an obligation also to engage with the landowners there to maybe delay mowing or whatever. So it's not necessarily part of the LIFE project, but we would be able to step in and engage with the landowner under a scheme that has been running since 1993, actually, the corncrake grant scheme, and that would pay landowners to delay the mowing.
So there is a bit of flexibility then, yeah.
Barry, a terrible thought occurs to me. As you describe it, 150-odd calling males, now that has been the situation for a decade, 2 decades or something like that. So the population declined and plateaued. Now, a thought occurs to me, and that is the danger of what they call consanguinity, a lovely big word meaning inbreeding, more or less. Is the population too small to generate the diversity that it needs to survive? Or have we any handle on that? Are cornflakes so confined that they always come to
corn
the same place?
Cornflakes or corncrakes?
Did I say flakes? I never eat
is
the
it cornflakes?
I'm sorry, terrible. It's my age, you see. I'm worse than the corncrake. But anyway, is there a problem like this? Do we know? Can we collect DNA from corncrakes? The males can easily be caught, I know, but the females not so easily. Can we do anything with this? Is there a hope of Scottish corncrakes coming in, or corncrakes in the north of Europe coming in, some genes into the population?
The key thing really is, I suppose, to work with what we have and to produce the habitat, and hopefully the birds will come thereafter. I remember a time when in the Mullet Peninsula there wasn't all that many corncrakes actually, and the population has increased there through the types of schemes that we've had in the past. So I would be hopeful that the population can respond. In terms of DNA testing, it's not going to be one of the objectives of the project, but with our project partners in Fota Wildlife Park, there will be a facility if there happen to be any corncrakes captured. If there was a situation whereby corncrake had to be rescued or whatever, then they would be able to host them. And they have some corncrakes there already, actually. So maybe there is some scope for something there, but it's not one of the objectives of the project. The core objectives would be to work with local landowners and farmers and local communities to restore the habitats and to increase the population.
Will you tell me the answer to something that's been puzzling me for years? Why are they not on the Aran Islands anymore? They used to be there up to the 80s. There's no combine harvesters there. They're not making silage.
I know.
The land use is the same as it ever was. So, I mean, they used to come, they don't come anymore. Why not?
Absolutely. And I was out there last year, actually, at the end of the Aran LIFE project conference, and that's another LIFE project that our department would have been involved in. And I just, the thought really crossed my mind as well, why are corncrakes not here? Because it just seems ideal for them, because you have this situation whereby, a bit like the burn, there's winterage areas whereby the cattle don't graze these meadows or grasslands during the summertime. They're left alone. So you imagine that would be perfect for the corncrakes.
Yeah, they haven't changed.
And no great amount of predators and, you know, no big machinery, like you say. So, yeah, it's a real head scratcher, right? And was it the 1970s or something like that since they were there?
82, I think, was the last one. Because we used to go every amazing. Year, so we used to hear them
Don
every
Conroy
year.
Used to be involved in the summer school. Where was that? Do you remember?
That was on
Inishbofin.
That's right.
That was the one and only time I ever saw a corncrake in the flesh.
Bofin is a great place for Corncrake.
That's
and,
right.
You know,
and
a lot of tourists go there.
As well, yeah.
A lot of tourists go there to hear the Corncrake. So, you know, just bringing
money
into the area.
Yeah, Torrey Island is a great
Torrey
place
also,
as well. Yeah,
absolutely, yeah.
That's a good place. But they are an island, so you'll have to kidnap one and put it there. Because, so it would seem to indicate there's some truth to the fact that they're not coming. Because, I mean, you know, it wasn't that they were mowed to death or killed on the Aran Islands. So maybe they just didn't make it across the Sahel and the Sahara when they were coming back. Michael O'Mara did a great project on that way back in the 70s. And that was the first research on the corncrakes. And that was at the beginning of the decline. And he was pointing out at that stage, because he had done some work in Africa, that the actual climate change was causing desertification in Africa, that the nomadic tribes who used to move on with their cattle and graze and move on because of population increases and because of the dryness of the soil, they couldn't move on, so that they were in fact grazing and staying in their areas, causing then the soil to be impoverished and the Sahara to get wider. So the poor old corncrake, which is actually not like the swallows and those who feed up in the air on insects, they feed on the ground. So you take a big deep breath at the bottom of the Sahara, fly across and come down, phew, in Morocco, and there you are. But now you don't do it in the night. You come down and it's still arid. There's still no food. How do you revive yourself to keep going the next day? So that was even then. So, I mean, that could well have an implication on places like the Aran Islands. Not that we did anything to them there, but they didn't make it.
Yeah.
So it's all to play for. It'll be great news now to see how it works.
I hope it works, because since I got into this business of making nature programmes, almost three decades ago, they've been talking about the corncrake and the plight of the corncrake. Am I right? Am I wrong, Barry?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember as a young lad actually going to meetings about the corncrake as well. It was one of my first memories of conservation. Yeah, so it's been going on a long time. Thankfully, we have sustained, you know, we haven't lost the corncrake from Ireland. I think that's something to reflect on as well. Thank God we haven't, because it's been a soundtrack to our landscape and it's part of Ireland, it's part of our island as much as any of us, and we would hate to lose it for future generations. So thankfully there are still some, and we need to hold on to them and we need to build on that population.
And for the last 2 years it's been the soundtrack to the Dawn Chorus, as you heard at the beginning of this interview, because we've been hearing the corncrakes sing live at the very beginning of the programme, because they're singing right through the night and into the early hours of the morning, which has been fantastic for us.
If you could call it singing.
Well, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Vocalisations. But listen, talk to me about GMIT and drones and modern technology and following the corncrake.
So I suppose there's, you know, when you think about corncrake, maybe some people think it might be like, oh, going back to old ways or whatever. But, you know, there's a really pioneering novel elements to this project also, and I may have touched on it earlier on, the passive acoustic monitoring that's being done on GMIT, listening for the individual corncrakes and analysing their sonograms to tell each individual apart. But also there is going to be a trial. Now, whether it works or not remains to be seen, but if it works, it will be fantastic. We want to see if we can pick out or identify where exactly the corncrakes are nesting, because to date it's been very, very difficult, because the female doesn't make a whole lot of calls. She stays quiet. She wants to keep her chicks safer. She wants to keep her safe herself. It's the fellas that do all the shouting as usual. We want to be able to see if we can pick out, through thermal imaging, pick out the female sitting on a nest through the heat signals that she might be giving off, hopefully. And if you're out in the field with a thermal imaging camera, maybe you're holding it at 6 foot high or whatever height you might be, then you are not able to see through the grass. So to get up above the grass, we would need to use drones. So we will have thermal imaging cameras attached onto a drone and fly overhead and hopefully be able to pick it out. If we are able to pick out the nest, that would mean a lot, because then we can engage directly with that farmer and say, look, it's this field that needs to be delayed, rather than having to delay maybe 4 or 5 fields that we think that she might be in. So that would be really great if we were able to prove that we can pick out the corncrakes through thermal imaging.
Barry, a thought occurs to me there. If you can find the nest like that from the air, you could take away the early eggs and the bird will lay again and raise them, as they have done in Fota, under hens or something. And just when they are about to be released, take them back so that they see the stars for the first time in the place where their real mother was. You could, in fact, greatly increase the number of young produced here. Is that a viable idea, or is it nonsense?
It's not part of the project objectives, but it is a viable idea in that it has been trialled with other species, and it's called head starting. It's taking the eggs or taking the chicks from the most vulnerable time of their lives and giving them a head start in life. So it's something that is an acknowledged conservation method, but it's not something that is part of this project.
It would be frightening, I think, to go up and search for a corncrake and steal its eggs. It seems an awful thought. I mean, the locals would string you up for doing such a thing, apart from anything else. But if you could in advance locate the nest precisely, it would be, you could go in quite quickly and with minimal disturbance take an egg or two, leaving the rest. I mean, they lay huge clutches anyway. So you could, it's a viable proposition without causing too much distress to the birds, or is it?
Like I said, it has been trialled, it has been done elsewhere, and I suppose the first thing is to see if the thermal imaging works, and if
can
it does,
find,
that might open
nests,
up a new vista for all manner of...
Yeah, you could look for curlew nests with that too, presumably the curlews are not in great shape either.
Yeah,
no, but you don't want to get distracted, you want to focus on the corncrakes and solve this problem for once and for all, if that is at all possible. It would be great if it were, and I can tell you, I'll let you into a little secret, Barry, because I'm working on a proposal for a new television project following on from Back from the Brink. And we're going to be featuring the corncrake, so we're going to get in touch
wonderful.
With you hopefully very shortly. It's great news for you guys, and we wish you the very best of luck with this project.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Barry.
Good luck,
Thanks.
Barry.
Hi, good luck.
Hey,
bye.
Guys, just while I have you there
yes.
as well, I heard earlier on you were talking about Oris and Uachtaráin, and just a nice little segue, if you'd like to mention it at some stage, is that in Oris and Uachtaráin, that used to be Lord Lieutenant's Palace and the Lord and Lady that were there, and back in the day, maybe even up to 100 years ago, the constables of the RIC, you know, whether you might want to mention that or not.
Warning,
they would have actually, one of their jobs would have actually been to stop the corncrakes craking at night so that the Lord and Lady could get a night's sleep.
How did they do that? Bait them on the head?
I don't know, maybe flushing them out of the grass, I'm not sure.
But that was their job,
it's
anyway,
an interesting
to tell
little
them to shut up.
So
even the Phoenix Park then, 100 years ago, or before 1920, was full of corncrakes.
Corncrakes, yeah, that's right.
Although, mind you, when I went to UCD, me and Finn McCool, in the 1970s, there were corncrakes out in Belfry beside the water tower. Because we used to hear them going in and out, because we used to come on the 11 bus and walk in. We used to walk on those days. Imagine we had legs. And you went down by the water tower, which is where it was a kind of a pondy place. And the corncrakes were there in 1970s in Clonskin.
Wow.
So there you go. I begin to feel like Finn McCool now. Or
we'll stay listening and we'll hear the first of Terry's reports from Oris and Uachtaráin towards the end of the programme. Barry, thanks very much indeed.
Cheers, guys. Thank
Bye.
You. Take care.
Good luck, Terry. Bye-bye.
Now, here's a question for anyone out there who's a bit of a nature enthusiast like Aina and Richard. If you had the choice to go absolutely anywhere in the world and witness any wildlife behaviour in the natural world, where and what would it be? Aina and Ilana.
I would like to go and see humpback whales performing before my very eyes. Instead of arriving when they were there yesterday, or they're coming tomorrow and they'll be here next week. So that could happen off the west coast of Cork if I was as lucky as other people are or whatever. But I would love to see humpback whales with their tails up in the air and they're jumping around the place. That would be the ideal thing.
Richard?
I choose the blue whale because I've seen the humpbacks jumping up and down and it's wonderful. But the blue whale is the largest creature ever to have lived, as far as we know. Well, they are just animal. They're trees, of course, which are bigger. But I would like to get up close to one of those. That would be such a marvelous experience. And you could do it about 150 kilometres west of Ireland if you were extremely lucky and didn't suffer terribly from seasick.
Well, I would like to see orcas in the Norwegian fjords. I've gone on several occasions, and each time I've gone up there, the weather has been too bad and the little ribs, the rubber inflatable boats, couldn't go out because the waves are too high. I'd love to see that. The lovely sounds of the orcas would be just terrific. Ooh, beautiful. Or go and marvel at the Mexican free-tailed bats living in vast colonies and underground caves and swooping into moonlit skies. Or why not, on second thoughts, stay much closer to home and savour one of the most spectacular sights in nature, which is taking place right now, right here in Ireland. Just before dusk, as the skies slowly begin to darken, allow yourself to be bewitched by mesmerizing starling murmurations, made up of hundreds of thousands of starlings swirling through the skies in unison. The murmurations occur just before the birds swoop down and settle into their roost for the night. Such awe-inspiring aerial displays can be seen right across the country, but there's one particular place in Belfast, just above the Albert Bridge, where I love to go at this time of year. The starlings have been roosting beneath the bridge for more than 20 years now, and their shape-shifting spectacles are simply stunning. I went there recently and I met with Anne-Marie McDevitt, who's head of species at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in Northern Ireland.
Welcome, Derek. We're here standing at Albert Bridge in Belfast City Centre, waiting for the starlings to come in and roost in under the bridge.
Well, they've already started to come in by the looks of it. Small group up there now.
Yeah, we had four at the start, three added onto those, and they're just circling the bridge at this time now, and that'll just build up and build up now.
Anne-Marie, can you describe the scene for me, please?
Well, at the minute you've got very small, a flock of about sort of seven or eight, and then two or three birds are coming in at a time and that flock is building. Starlings are funny little birds, they've kind of got triangular wings, so they look kind of very, very fluttery in flight. Here's another little flock joining in, and it's going to collide with the, hopefully with the first flock. No, didn't do
well,
that.
It's not going to collide with them, it's going to join up.
Yeah.
That's the most extraordinary thing about them. No matter how many birds you see up there, and there could be thousands. I mean, I saw a report saying there can be anything up to 30,000 starlings here in this murmuration over the Albert Bridge in Belfast.
Yeah, so I mean, I've heard that as an estimate. I think people probably don't know exactly how many there are, but yeah, that amount. And I think what happens with them is they sort of keep this, a big term is inter-individual distance. They keep a bit of space between each other, and they're just very kind of quick-witted birds. So when one moves, the others all move around it, and then you get that kind of flock effect.
And it's extraordinary to see it, isn't it? That they don't collide. They never crash into each other. How do they manage to do it?
They never collide. And what's amazing is we were talking earlier about the fact that if a bird of prey comes, it can kind of split the flock. So, you know, it's trying to get at one of the birds. And obviously, this flock and behaviour is a really good deterrent against predators. Mm. Really hard for a predator to pick out. Like a bird of prey, to pick out one bird in the midst of that. But sometimes when the predator comes, like a sparrowhawk or a peregrine, it can just split the flock in two, and that's a really amazing thing to see.
There is a resident peregrine falcon around here, isn't there?
Yes, there is, and well, it's a good place, I guess. There's plenty of starlings about, so.
Yeah, it's a good place to find some food. This must be my fifth or sixth year on the trot for coming up to the Albert Bridge at this time of year and at this time of day. It's now 4 p.m. Yeah. In the afternoon. People are making their way home from work. Some people going home that little bit early. Lots of traffic on the bridge. And we're still the only ones standing here. It's something I've noticed all the time. When I come up, I seem to be the only person standing here looking up. People are still unaware of what's going on above their heads.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people probably walking home see them all the time and just kind of keep their head down and keep going. Maybe they're also worried about some other effects of the starlings. But but there are people you can clearly see that have never seen them before. And you do occasionally see a person kind of almost, you know, walking agape, looking up at them, because it is one of the most amazing wildlife spectacles. I was just looking online earlier, and I think they have us down in one of the sort of top 10 sites, you know, across the UK and Ireland for starling murmuration.
Well, I'm not surprised. I've been to many starling murmurations around the country, but this is the most consistent in terms of a place you can stand and it's going to happen over your head.
Yeah.
You could be in Loch Ennell, for example, in County Westmeath, and you could be one side of the loch and the starling murmuration will happen on the other side of the loch. Now, it's still a spectacular sight, but it's not right in front of you. But here at the Albert Bridge, it's right over your head, because they roost under the bridge.
Yeah.
It's a three-eyed bridge, three arches.
Yeah, and it's incredible noise, and then you get the echo from the bridge and the water underneath it, so it's a real cacophony when they come in as well. But what they'll be starting to do too across Belfast, which is even really nice, is on the big pylons and on the wires, they'll be gathering up, kind of just looks like song notes, you know, and that'll be happening all over. They'll form small flocks, and then all these small flocks will come in. So there we've got now, they're starting to build up a wee bit, and these two flocks have come together, so we've probably got about 30 birds now.
Yeah, and it's starting with four. Isn't that great? And they're coming from all directions.
So, as you said, that there are flocks of starlings in loads of different places. They can come into industrial structures like this, but they also come into reed beds, and there's a really good roost in County Down where they come into a patch of conifers out in the middle of farmland, and it's a really big roost as well.
And the $60 million question, Anne-Marie, what's it all about?
So I think the feeling is these are birds that pretty much spend a lot of time in flocks. So one of the feelings is this is to protect them from predators. And what they're doing when they are going on onto the bridge is that their safety in numbers. It's also warmer. So cities in general have, you know, or can be a couple of degrees warmer, so that's really important, and it's a safe place. And there's some thoughts that what they're doing is exchanging information. And they can maybe exchange information on food sources. They're quite unusual that even in the nesting season, they form little feeding flocks. And then they also apparently form daytime flocks as well. So really for them, flocking is a really natural behaviour. A lot of birds just do it over the winter, but they do it in the breeding season, during the day, and now again in the evening.
Now, are these resident birds here, or are they coming in from somewhere?
They're a mix of things. They're our residents. So starlings are, they breed here and they winter here, and that means that they're resident. But we get big numbers of birds coming down from Northern Europe, where it's far too cold, and I guess the ground is because hard and frosty, and they're coming down here to feed. So we're really, yeah, we're boosted by big numbers coming from Northern Europe.
I wonder how fast their wings beat.
Yeah, I don't know, because what you're seeing there is, if you look closely, what you're seeing is a flutter, 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 and then a soar. So they're soaring as they're turning in direction, and that's what's giving you that kind of swarmy bee-like effect, really.
So now I think we'll just wait until the big flock arrives, and they perform in their aerial ballet. Now 20 past four. We've been here for about 25 minutes or thereabouts, and that flock has really built up. In fact, some of the birds are dropping under the bridge now to roost for the night.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to me as if we've probably got a few thousand birds now, and I think it's just going to build and build. Oh, here we have what looks like a barge coming in under the bridge as well. Yes, it is. Yeah, so some of them look as if they were going under the bridge, but in general what they do is they do this little practice run. They kind of go in under the bridge but come out the other side, so... But you can see in under the bridge, if you look closely, that there's loads and loads of little ledges. And obviously that's what they're going in to sit on. And it's so safe from anything. I can't imagine anything really being able to get at them in underneath the bridge there.
Now, you want to talk to me about your bird survey.
Yeah, so we've got the Big Garden Bird Watch coming up on the 25th to the 27th of January. And this is a really great... opportunity for you to take people to take an hour out of their time and look, count the birds in their garden. And for us, we get great information then on what's happening to garden birds, and then we're able to tell you things such as starling last year was number 2 on the top 10 on the Big Garden Bird Watch list.
Oh, that's fantastic, isn't it?
It is.
I often wonder about those lists. Is it because people are familiar with the birds, or they see them, if you know what I mean? So they can see lots of birds, don't know what they are, so they don't count them. But when they're familiar with a bird, they see it, now they know it, and they're able to register it. So everybody can identify a blackbird, everybody can identify a robin, and now you're saying people know what starlings look like. That's terrific.
No, I think they probably are pretty accurate, because we give people a little leaflet, and on the leaflet you have the kind of the top, you know, garden birds that you see.
Description as well, yeah.
Yeah, and the scientists have kind of set it up in such a way that we should get really good data from it. But it's a really important survey, and it's what we call citizen science. It's having ordinary people are doing science when they do it.
Well, we'll put the details of how you can take part in that survey on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. It's been a fantastic visit here to Belfast yet again to see these starlings, which are still performing in their aerial ballet above our heads. It's really terrific. There are several thousand birds up there now, and still small flocks coming in north, south, east and west to join this big murmuration in the sky before they eventually settle down under that bridge for the evening. And then in the morning they'll head off looking for food, and they'll come back here again tomorrow evening around the same time, and they'll do it all over again. Isn't nature wonderful?
So they're now they're going into about a, I suppose, a big loose ball shape, and they're soaring over our heads. Yeah, and more birds are coming in, sometimes just individuals, little flocks of 3 and 4 attaching themselves onto this big moving swarm.
Let me tell you that if you go to the website now or after the programme, you can have a look at these birds performing, because what I'm going to do now is stop talking myself. I'm going to get up my phone and I'm going to record them for you.
Thanks very much indeed to Anne-Marie McDevitt from the RSPB. And as I said at the end of that report, I made a little video, so you can go onto our website, rte.ie/Mooney, and have a look at them for yourself. It really is a terrific sight. But as we've mentioned, you can go and see them pretty much anywhere in the country. So just keep an eye and an ear out. All right. Simple as that. And it continues right until the end of February. And it's free. Now, increasingly, our weather seems to be anything but predictable, with gardens already waking up from their winter slumber. Snowdrops are coming into bloom, and shoots of daffodils and wild plants are eagerly peeping above the ground. Wherever you are, nature's steady stirring can be keenly felt. But if you're living in or visiting Dublin, a trip at this time of year to the Phoenix Park, the largest walled park in Europe, can be one that's hard to beat. With almost 2,000 acres of green space, the park enjoys an incredible richness of flora and fauna, from its iconic wild deer to its vast deciduous tree cover, to its diverse mammal and bird species, not to mention the zoo. But just like a Russian doll, within that magnificent wildlife haven lies another refuge, which is the 130-acre grounds of Oros Anuktoron. President Michael D. Higgins is currently welcoming a specialist team of ecologists from Trinity College Dublin to conduct a detailed year-long biodiversity audit in order to protect this natural environment both now and into the future. Our reporter Terry Flanagan went to the Oros to find out more. And the first person he spoke with was Margaret Gormley, Chief Park Superintendent with the Office of Public Works, which has joined forces with Trinity in conducting this new study.
Margaret, you're the Chief Park Superintendent with the Office of Public Works, and you're responsible for kicking off this whole project here. Tell us a little bit about it.
The Office of Public Works is delighted to be working with Trinity College on the biodiversity audit here in Oros Anuktoron. The Oros grounds here is an oasis in the centre of Dublin, and we're very, very keen. When the President asked us, would we look at the biodiversity in particular in Oros? He has a very strong agenda on biodiversity and climate change. He has spoken at the National Conference on Biodiversity, and it was one of his strands that he really wanted us to focus on here in Phoenix Park, in particular in the grounds of Oros Anuktoron.
Well, if we look at the Oros here, the Oros is slap bang in the middle of the Phoenix Park, and the Phoenix Park is, I think, the largest public park in Ireland and probably second largest public park in the world, and it's a unique habitat. And I suppose the Oros is something even more unique because it's in the middle of it, and it's slightly different. Tell us a little bit about the park first.
Well, the park was originally set up as a royal deer park in 1662. So it was enclosed to keep deer in and the people out, where today it's very, very different. But the landscape that we have today is really inherited from a deer grazing of the grounds of the whole Phoenix Park. And I think what is unique within the Oros itself, because this is an area, you know, within the Phoenix Park, that the deer have no access to the Oros. So the understory here in the park is very, very different to the understory that you would get out in the main Phoenix Park.
So there's no way that deer can actually get into the Oros.
If they try to jump in over the wall, they or over the ha-ha, they could. But no deer have. We had deer in here till about 10, 15 years ago. And then the deer were moved out into the Phoenix Park. And we've managed to maintain a secure environment here in the Oros, where we're able to, you know, let the leaves fall on the ground, let, you know, all the different habitats grow here in the Phoenix Park and evolve. And it's very different, you know, within the Oros than out in the Phoenix Park. If you go for a stroll in the Phoenix Park, you will see all the trees, they're browsing, you know, are right up to the head height of a deer. Mm-hmm. People mightn't realise that.
Which you don't see here.
No, you can see here the trees, the planting. We can let different areas grow up, and we have like different zones for management. You know, we do a light touch management and grass management here within the Oros. So obviously for heads of state and the president coming in and out, there will be an area that's very well manicured. But back behind that, we will let the grass naturalise, mm-hmm, and let all the various plants come up through that. Where if that was out in the Phoenix Park, it would just be really more a grass mix that you would have.
And it's not just the herbaceous plants, because I'm looking around me here, I'm amazed by the amount of fungi and the variety of fungi that are here. You wouldn't see that outside in the park.
No, you would see a little bit out in the park, but here within the Oros, because we don't have the compaction from the deer or even, you know, the public to that extent, you can see the different levels of the biodiversity, you know, all the different species, the fungi. We've over 70 different types of mosses alone in the Phoenix Park.
Have you done any audits on the park before, a biodiversity audit?
We're all the time doing different studies on the Phoenix Park. Like, we have 35% of all birds that occur in Ireland have been recorded in the Phoenix Park, a number of the endangered and orange listed birds. We have 50% of all mammals that occur in Ireland have been recorded within the Phoenix Park. Like, we know we've 20 badger sets in the Phoenix Park.
20?
20, six social groups of badger sets. Now, we know where they are. We don't promote that information widely. But the park is a hugely, hugely important area from a biodiversity point of view, and the studies have been done. But I think what is unique with this particular study, it's a year-long study.
So what will you be looking for, or what will you be looking at?
We're looking at everything. All ecosystems within the Oros. Like, in the Phoenix Park generally, we have over 25 different types of habitats, 5 different types of grassland. So we're looking at all of that here within the Oros itself. And I think it'll be very interesting because, you know, some of the areas within the Auris are very well maintained. You know, you're visiting heads of state, formal parterres that were established in the 1800s. And then you have other areas like the wilderness area, which historically was called a wilderness right through the centuries. So to look at all those different habitats and to see, like, we just don't want to record what is here at this particular period of time. We want to look at what good recommendations are we going to get to see how can we improve this from a biodiversity point of view, but yet retain the historical setting here in the Auris.
Now, you said you're going to look at everything. I know, for instance, the fungi are one. What else? You'll be looking at the herbaceous plants?
We're looking at fungi, we're looking at insects, we're looking at aquatics, we're looking at the trees, we're looking at the herbaceous layer.
So really what you're looking to do, first of all, is find out what is there here and what's doing well and what's not doing so well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we will get a very good baseline study, and then the recommendations that will come out of this, you know, how can we improve this area for biodiversity? Which will be very, very key, because you can look around you here and you can see like areas where we only cut the grass once a year. And when you walk through these areas, you'll actually see young seedlings of oak trees. We're actually working with Chagas at the moment for planting ash trees in here within the grounds of Auris that are resistant to Shalara, the dieback disease. Mm-hmm. So we're all the time looking, how can we improve the biodiversity and the offering that this wonderful location has to offer?
So this project will take a year. I presume then you will publish shortly afterwards.
Absolutely. We're going to publish the report, because really this information, you know, is scientific information that people can learn from and learn from our experiences here in, you know, in how we manage the grounds of Auris and Uachtaráin. This is a cultural landscape in a city centre, and it's very, very unique. And I think, you know, even not just within the Irish context, but internationally.
And do you think your results will differ from various audits that you've done in the park over the years? Because it is really a subset of the park here.
It's a subset of the park, but it's the most comprehensive audit that we'll have ever done. So I think in that sense, it will be very unique. You're looking at how all the different habitats interact with each other. Like in the past, we might have looked at a deer study, or we look at a tree study, but we look at them separately, where this report will be very unique. It will look at how all these habitats and ecosystems interact with each other, and then the benefits of that, that we can derive from that, that we will be able to roll out, not alone just in the Phoenix Park, but maybe some of our other sites as well.
Terry Flanagan talking to Margaret Gormley, Chief Park Superintendent with the Office of Public Works. Over the next 12 months, the ecology team will quantify both habitat and species diversity on the site, which features both formal and certified organic kitchen gardens, grasslands, wooded areas, and a lake. On board for this project are plant, fungi, insect, bird, mammal, reptile, and amphibian experts. And next week, we'll be hearing from Dr. Paul Dowding, a mycologist and lecturer in botany at Trinity College Dublin. He's also been speaking with Terry at the Auris. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Aine Ní Lana and Richard Collins. Our researcher is John Riley. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our producer, Sheila O'Callaghan. And on sound, we have Mark McGrath. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney. And if you'd like to hear more about starlings, check out the Mooney Goes Wild documentary archive at rte.ie/Mooney.
Anxious to get up close and personal with the starling roost, we headed for Belfast and boarded the Sasha, a boat operated by the Department of Social Development in Northern Ireland. Our skipper, Ronald Surgener, took us for a short journey upstream on the River Langan to the Albert Bridge.
You can see at the minute now the birds are all starting to sort of gather up in the massive big flock, but they're slowly but surely, the old birds coming down for a prospect in below. Once it gets through safely, the rest of the birds drop on behind. It's nearly like water running. Just the whole flock just drops at once, and they start all individually, sort of one at a time, and then all of a sudden there's a massive movement and the whole lot will come down.
Yeah, it's almost as if they close their wings and fall, isn't it? They drop down, and quite suddenly the whole lot comes down together. It's a remarkable sight, isn't it?
It's amazing just to watch the whole flock just in one go, just all of a sudden the sky's clear.
You're here every night, more or less. Now, is it the same procedure every night, or does the weather affect it? Do they come down? We've a bit of rain right now. Is that going to bring them down earlier?
Yeah, the weather evenings, the birds don't tend to hang about as much. You don't get such a good show. But if you get a lovely, calm, clear evening, the birds will hang about maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, in the air, where you end up with maybe 15,000-20,000 birds in one go, but a wet night they break up in smaller flocks and just drop straight in.
But they come in from every side, so this is a kind of centre. It's not just south of the river alone or anything
no,
like that.
No, no, Belfast is sort of, it's quite a small city, so the countryside all around it, and the birds just come from all directions. That's where you get the small flocks, maybe 20, 30, 40 birds coming in wee dribs and drabs, joining the large flock then.
Now, as we slip in under the bridge, we're going to be unable to record anything because the noise is getting louder and louder. What are they saying to each other, I wonder?
Not too sure whether they're telling each other where the food is or what the idea of the murmuration is. They watch and see where the large flocks are coming in from, so the birds will be the following day know to head out that direction. Nobody really knows. That's the whole mystery about it.
And for wildlife documentaries on starlings and much, much more besides, check out rte.ie/Mooney.